Hey folks, you're listening to Know the Land, broadcasting from the Treaty Territories of the Mississauga Credit on 93.3 FM at the University of Guelph. Or maybe you're listening to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It's a show about our connections with the land base, how we interact with the land, how we learn about the land, how we defend the land. My name is Byron, and today I wanted to highlight a plant that I've come to know and appreciate very much. And this plant is water hemlock. And I'll get into why I like it so much as the show goes on. But this is part of the species profile series that I've been doing and focusing on different species that are coming up right now. Either fruit or whatever that I might commonly encounter right now or been seeking out. I'm recording it in a strange place. I'm actually sitting in a car in a graveyard on the side of Highway 6 in Gray County. And I pulled over earlier and I was going to record by a river, but the traffic noise was still too loud, so this is actually quieter than it was where I was by the river. And then it also started to rain. And I'm not sure if it's entirely past yet, but from my angle, the sun's out and the clouds seem to be behind me. So the birds are singing. So perhaps the rain has passed. So I figure I'll record it here. And if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I hope it does. So I've had a really long curiosity with water hemlock, the Latin name being Cicuta maculata. And I'll get into some of why I really liked it and why it's taught me so much. Or why they've taught me so much. It's not it. Why they've taught me so much. This plant, even from its name, even from their name, pardon me while I work on that, even from their name, maculata, it taught me Latin, looking at this name. The plant's name taught me Latin by understanding maculata to be connected to the word immaculate. I grew up in a Christian family, and when you talked about immaculate, you talked about like a possible virgin birth in the mythology of Christianity. So immaculate would be without spot, without blemish. And so maculata implies spots. And so often on plants, like the Joe Pye weed, you've got Eutrichia maculata. And so it says, you know, it's spotted Joe Pye weed. That's the specific species. The maculatus is spotted. And while the plant's name taught me the Latin through that key, that was like the Rosetta Stone for me to understand how Latin works with the rest of the common languages that I know right now, that I'm exposed to, of English and French mostly. It's not actually that spotted, but I'll get into that. There are spots on it occasionally, but we'll get into that. But I thought that the name was very important. Perhaps water hemlock is probably the most or one of the most poisonous plants on Turtle Island or North America. And in light of that, of course, my heart would glow and be warm to this plant. I misidentified them for a couple of years, thinking I knew who they were, but it wasn't until the past 4 or 5 years that I really began taking a closer look, seeking them out, learning the lore, reading the sometimes sparse literature on the plant. This episode of the radio, which is derived from a blog post that I wrote, a species profile, is an effort to collect my thoughts and my learning about this plant to assist not only with a proper ID, but to deepen that relationship a little bit more. Water hemlock is in the Apiaceae family, or the carrot family, which contains about 300 genera and 3,000 species from around the world. Some of those most widely known plants in the family are plants that we use for food. So in this area, in this culture, I love carrot, Daucus carota, subspecies sativus, the cilantro and coriander, same plant, Coriandrum sativum, dill, Anethium graveolens, celery, Apium graveolens, anise, Pimpinella anisum, Angelica. Angelica is also just the name of the genus, and so many more. And the carrot family is known for plants that can harm humans also, such as the giant hogweed, Heraculum mantigazianum, poison hemlock, Conium maculatum, and other species in the Cicuta genus, the same genus as the water hemlock. They're known for their compound umbel flowers, if you think of like an umbrella that got blown out by the wind, turned out inside out by a strong gust. I think of it, I've seen it more in movies than actually in real life. All members of this genus, not the family, but all members of the genus, Cicuta, are incredibly toxic. They're understood as some of the most deadly plants on the continent, and often mistook for one of their more edible cousins. When I first noticed this plant, I wasn't confusing it for other Apiaceae families. I think I was confusing it a lot with rue, because it has this white, kind of poofy flower. I'm not sure how you describe it, but it often grew in wetter spots as well. And I just didn't know it well, and I thought that the rue was the water hemlock. And then as I've come to know water hemlock, I've come to know other species that are very similar lookalikes. But I'll get into those soon. It's usually found on damp ground and wet places, swamps, low meadows, riversides, roadside ditches, wet woodland edges. From Nova Scotia to Alaska, south to Mexico, it's common across most of the continent, and it's a native species. It's an upright herbaceous perennial, about 60 to 225 centimeters tall, with rigid stalks originating in a thick base. There's purple, usually at the base, right where it's coming out of the ground. The stalk is smooth and green, sometimes spotted with purple, or sometimes solidly purple. And I believe that this is depending on the sun exposure. And it's chambered at the base, right above the roots. So the root has, as it comes out of the ground, you get that base of the stalk. There are these sort of cells within it, almost as if like the organ pipe mud dauber creates these cells for its young. Maybe that's too obscure a reference. Just these little pockets of air within the hollow of the stem with a piece of tissue, a flat piece of tissue going across the entire stem, blocking these chambered cells. It's alternately branched, pinnately divided two or three times, so it means that, like, instead of one big leaf like on a basswood or a maple, it's divided three times. So first you get the first stem, and then you get another little stem come off of it, and then a leaflet coming off that. Sometimes it's a little bit less than that, but sometimes it's a bit more. So you get the one stem, and then leaflet, 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 like a bunch of little leaflets. It's coarsely toothed at the edges, sawtoothed at the edges of the leaflets. and they're lance-shaped, or like some people imagine the tip of a narrow spear tip. They're about 3 to 10 centimeters long, and the veins running along the length of the leaf, the main vein runs along the length of the leaf and then shoots off from the side, a bunch of them, and they run to the base of the V in the cut on the tooth leaf. So if you can imagine the cut of the tooth leaf, so there's these pointy parts and those sinuses where it sticks into the leaf, not the pointy parts that stick out of the leaf, but the sinuses that stick in. The vein from the leaf goes right up to the corner or the edge, the sharp edge of the V of that sinus. And one way that people used to identify it was through the phrase vein to the cut, pain in the gut, because none of the other Apiaceae have that vein going right to the V in the sinus of the teeth, between the teeth. It's got these white flowers about 35 millimeters across with 5 petals, 5 sepals, 5 stamens. And these tiny little flowers are clustered together in umbels about 5 to 10 centimeters across, or about 2 to 4 inches. They flower usually between July and August. And these umbels are similar to the wild carrot, but less compact, which I'll get into more later. The fruit that develops from these flowers reminded me of sort of a fancy looking lute. They're broadly oval overall, they're flat on one side, and they're striped with dark brown against the pale woody beigey brown. They're about 2 to 3 millimeters wide. The fruit, which is actually a schizocarp, I might get into that later, it's not that important, ripen around August to September, and then it splits into 2 parts, each containing a single seed. And that's pretty much what schizocarp means, you know, it splits. The roots, and this is a part to remember, the roots are white or off-white with multiple tuberous rootlets. And I've seen up to 10 when collecting and when looking at the roots. It looks like a bunch of pale carrots or parsnips. And they smell similar to carrot and parsnip. But they're a bit smaller than a carrot, maybe about the length of a wild carrot, but a lot fatter. They exude a yellow oil when damaged or broken. And the roots are probably the most toxic part of the plant. And again, it smells like carrot or parsnip, not only just the roots, but I find the whole plant gives off a little bit of that smell, especially when those plant tissues are broken or torn. And I want to invite y'all to go to the website, toknowtheland.com/blog/exploringwaterhemlock, and you can see lots of photos that I've taken of the plant over the years. Similar species include wild carrot, Queen Anne's lace, that's the same one, Daucus carota, and it's differentiated from the water hemlock by the denser flower cluster, often with a singular dark purple flower in the middle of that lacy umbel. Also the long hairy stem, you can remember the queen's hairy legs. And it's less likely to grow in wetter areas, though I've seen them growing about 1 meter apart, separated by the grade of a roadway. Even the summer at the Arboretum in Guelph, there was one stand of wild carrot with like a few, maybe 4 or 5 flower heads, and then 1 meter away down the grade in the wetter spot beside the promenade, the roadway, there was a huge water hemlock plant, probably about six feet tall, 2 meters, a little bit over that. So you can tell because the water hemlock does not have the hairs on the stalk. And I've been with other naturalists who have confused water parsnip, Cium suave, with water hemlock, as the flowers can be similar, but the leaf pattern is different. The Cium suave, the water parsnip, the leaves are only once pinnate, and they're opposite, and they're and as opposed to the 2 to 3 times pinnate compound leaves of the water hemlock, which is also alternate branching. The leaflets of the Cium Suave, they sort of clasp, or it looks like the leaves are holding on to the main stem of the leaflet. And they are seemingly, those little leaflets are opposite each other, opposite branching. Angelica can sometimes be confused, but the flower structure is much more globe-like, globular on the Angelica, and the leaves are quite a bit larger. Eastern hemlock, people confuse sometimes, Suga canadensis, but it doesn't look like water hemlock at all. It's not even related. It's a tall coniferous tree, and it looks more like a spruce than water hemlock, but it's got the same name. And actually, all these plants that I've just listed are edible, right? A lot of these plants, even the big hemlock, which can't be confused, but the Cium Suave, the water parsnip, the Angelica, the wild carrot, they're all edible, which helps understand why folks so often poison themselves with the water hemlock because of this mistaken identity. Another plant that's not in the same family, Bidens or beggar ticks, looks very similar to water hemlock when it's not in flower. And I have confused it before. I think this was the main plant that got me confused after I understood that the rue was not the water hemlock, because the leaves are similarly divided. They're lance-shaped. They're toothed and veined. The stalk can be purple, and they often grow right beside each other in wet places. The vein goes right to the cut a lot of the time, so that phrase to remember what it looks like, vein to the cut, pain in the gut, doesn't work here because this one looks a lot like it has the same characteristic. But the Bidens, the beggar ticks, Bidens frondosa, the species I most commonly encounter, the common beggar ticks, can be differentiated because of the opposite branching of the leaves, and when it's flowering, which is only a smaller time of the year, but when it's flowering, it has yellow disc florets, lacking ray florets, common to most other flowers in the aster family. So you can imagine like a daisy without the petals. A daisy without the petals, with lanceolate toothed leaves, opposite branching off the stalk. So opposite branching, that's a big, big key to separate them. Ecosystem function and associates. So what is the water hemlock doing there? You know, why is it growing there? What's its niche? And first, you know, those large bulbous roots that I was talking about, those tuberous roots, they stabilize the soil, protecting the riverbanks from erosion. They hold the soil together so that river just doesn't take off with the banks, which allows for other things to come and grow, which allows us to walk on the riverbank and allows all sorts of things to accumulate and develop steady, hard ground. So the river has a path to go on. It's a very great, great erosion prevention, especially when people know about water hemlock. Then they don't go to those spaces. They avoid those spaces where the water hemlock is, and allows other things to grow in eventually. And I've seen that all sorts of places. And as consideration for other wildlife, aside from the human, they're food for other wildlife. And I've heard two accounts of white-tailed deer browsing on the leaves, as though they're widely considered to be poisonous to all mammals. The Cicuta maculata, the water hemlock, is also known as a host plant for the black swallowtail butterfly and the caterpillar of a small moth, Ipomoea cicutatella, feeds on the flowers and the fruits of the water hemlock. A large number of wasps come to the flowers for nectar, including but not limited to the Anacrabro, Bembyx, Gasterruption, Monobia, Sapygia, Stesis, Tachypomalus, and the Vespula genera. There's one of the books I read named 52 species of wasp that come to the water hemlock, just in eastern North America, which is pretty awesome. Numerous pairs of common soldier beetles are found mating atop the flowers of the water hemlock. You'll see them a lot. They're little red beetles with a little black spot, and there's usually one on top of the other, always humping away on top of the inflorescence. How do you propagate it? How do you propagate it? Why do we want to propagate it? Because it's a native species. It's so good for these pollinators. It's so good for all these other species. I've been watching them a lot. A lot of flies and bees and wasps I keep visiting. So it's a beautiful plant. It's helpful. Just because it's not for us doesn't mean it's bad. So maybe it would be a good plant to propagate if you can do it in a safe way and have and make sure that the spot is safe and people won't encounter it by accident trying to eat it. And water hemlock is a perennial and it spreads through the roots. I've dug out water hemlock before that had gone to seed. Before they'd gone to seed, only to have them come back adjacent to that exact same spot where the plant was the year before. And I think it's because I left root particles in the ground there. And I'm unsure of how much of the root needs to remain for the plant to continue to keep growing, to proliferate. But I imagine small portions are enough to continue the growth. It may not be as robust or big as it was the year before, but I think it will continue on from there. Not only does water hemlock spread by the roots, but also those numerous seeds which fall to nearby waterways from the heads in late autumn. They're often carried downstream and deposited on shore during spring floods, and then they grow somewhere new. I'm going to get into a little bit more of why that's important, why it's important that we think about propagation of these plants, because it means a lot to me. But I want to get into some of the edible and medicinal uses, and there are none, no edible uses, not for humans. As far as I know, in all the research I've done, there's no edible uses for the plant. Do not consume violently toxic, the most toxic poisonous plant in North America. And toxic like how? Well, a friend who I identify as, I would identify at the time as being mid-20s, strong, very healthy, a farmer, consumed a portion of the root of an unknown plant which later induced sweating, difficulty breathing, seizures, blackout, and vomiting. He later identified the plant as water hemlock. And I'm going to interrupt what I'm talking about now to play you a portion of the interview I did with him where I asked him to tell about his experience consuming water hemlock. So this is from March 12th, 2018. So he did survive, and people do survive, but I want you to take a listen. Can you tell me your story about water hemlock?
Sure, yeah. Let me just put myself back there for a minute.
Yeah.
So this was during the time when I was working at this farm and really spending a lot of time in the field and kind of building skills about how to work with vegetables and all the different parts of that whole process, like what, you know, taking that plant from seed to harvest and, you know, how to handle that thing after it's harvested. And so really immersed in that world. So I had started building a real fascination with plants and all the different plants, and just, you know, really started to get clear about how many plants were around, not just in the field, but like edible weeds that we were working around, you know, such as like lamb's quarters or pigweed and mm-hmm. Some of these things that we were pulling out of the garden, and snacking as we went. And so just, you know, that sort of started to pique my interest, like, well, what else is out there? And, I had access to a great library there, so started to just flip through some books and say, oh, I recognize that plant, and I've heard about this thing, and actually one of the earliest books that I picked up was what's it called? Stalking the Wild Asparagus. And just a great classic book about foraging. And you know, just the descriptions in there. I wish I could remember one of the descriptions, but just like most of them are like, tastes great when it's fried in butter and, you know, served with bacon. It's like, it's hilarious. Like, well, what is it?
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, just some really cool things like cattails. Like I really learned a lot about how you, all the different stages of how you can eat cattails, and you know, you can use a pollen to make flour and all these fascinating things. I was like, wow, what a whole amazing world. And so, you know, I was just learning and sort of soaking up. I had, you know, it was like this time in my life where I was just like hungry for information, just sort of soaking it up and, you know, eating it wherever I could. And I got to attend this really interesting workshop at a farm down near London, and it was all about, you know, wild harvesting. And I think it was about like raw food as well. But anyway, the person who was giving the workshop, extremely experienced person, and was talking about just the vast number of edible plants that we have in our environment, and the tiny, tiny number of the ones that we do eat. You know, I don't remember. I would be making it up, but it was some, you know, minuscule percentage of what is edible, you know, do we actually consume. And that really struck me, like, wow, there's so much out there. And yeah, so that kind of, that was, you know, in my background. So as I was going through and foraging, and I guess, you know, to get to the story itself, I was at the farm, I was at the farmhouse. So, you know, and I, like I mentioned, I was just starting to get to know my current wife, Bethany. We were just starting to get to know each other and spending a lot more time together, and you know, sharing the different interests that we had, and we were both really keen to learn about edible plants. And you know, it was like some of the dates we would go on would just be like foraging around the farm and seeing what we could find. And you know, I have this very distinct memory of one day having this seemingly brilliant idea, like, hey, why don't every time we go out foraging, we just eat a new plant, because you know, there's always going to be a new one out there. We should just try to make that a goal. And so we went out foraging, and we, you know, picked some garlic mustard to make a pesto, and then we I don't remember all the things, but that was, I definitely remember, I have a clear memory of that, and I'll you know, get to why. And then we're walking along this area that was like leading to a field. There was sort of like a little creek running along one side of it. And I remember flipping open my book and seeing a plant. I was like, oh, that's an interesting looking plant. And then flipping open my book and then being like, oh, well, that plant looks like this thing in the book. And, you know, looking back now, it's like, oh my gosh, I was so, so naive. You know, flipping open the book, and I was like, yeah, that looks like this. And it was a hand-drawn illustration. You know, the plants, I think, were at different like stages of their life cycle, or at least, you know, in that life, in that stage of life cycle, the plant that I was looking at and the book that I was looking at, for whatever reason, looked similar to me. Looking back now, if I were to compare them, like, oh my God, they're not even close. Like, they have different growing habits. I think they have completely different growing conditions. But like I said, I mean, I was so excited, and I was so like just keen to just try stuff. And so that there was something in my mind that like made the connection, like it was sort of like making me think that it was more of a connection than it was.
Yeah.
I really wanted to believe it. So, you know, when I was reading the description, then it was for this plant called silverweed, and it said silverweed, you know, when you dig it up, has these tubers, and the tubers, when you roast them, taste like sweet potato. It sounds amazing. And so I was like, well, let's see. And so I pulled up the plant, and I somewhere around this time, you know, my partner Beth, who is a very intuitive person, she kind of looked at me and she's like, I don't know about this. Like, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, she was tuned into something that I was clearly not. And I was like, oh, it's fine. It's fine. Like, I mean, look at the book. It looks like it. And then in the back of my mind was this workshop that I had been at, like, you know, there's like whatever, I think it was like there's like 25,000 different edible plants in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, even if it's not in this book, the chances are that it's edible are pretty good. So anyway, I kind of bowled ahead and pulled up the plant or dug it out or whatever, and it had these big tubers on it. And so I was like, well, look, here's the sweet potato tubers. Fantastic.
There you go.
Yeah, and so we took them back to the house, and we made our, you know, garlic mustard pesto, and then we had some potatoes from the farm that we roasted up. We roasted up these tubers as well. And then, you know, we sat down to have dinner, and a friend of ours was over, too, and so she, you know, like, oh, this is blah, 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 this pesto that we made and all these potatoes from the farm. And then, oh, here's this cool, you know, tuber that we found out back behind the farm. It's silverweed. And so my friend ate, like, nibbled on it a little bit. She didn't really like it. And Beth ate some. I think she ate a bite or a couple bites. And, you know, I think, again, got this sort of intuitive feeling like, my body doesn't want to eat this. And I think she was kind of looking at me like, oh, yeah, that's bad news. And I was kind of like, oh, I think these are kind of good. And, like, you know, kind of, again, in that really naive way.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, they're not bad. They kind of taste like sweet potato. And then I'll never forget, we were watching this movie. We were watching The Lovely Bones, which is kind of a creepy movie. And so we started to get this really sort of weird, sickly feeling. And Bethany got up and she went to the bathroom and started throwing up.
Oh, man.
And Bethany has quite a lot of food sensitivities to begin with. And so at the time I was like, well, maybe there was something else that we ate that didn't agree with you. And I feel fine. And, you know, our friend here, she also seems fine. So whatever, let's just, whatever, we'll go to bed. And then, you know, we went to sleep. Beth wasn't feeling very well. She kind of upset stomach at this point. I was still feeling fine. I went to sleep. And I just remember having, like, super vivid dreams. And I'm not usually someone who remembers their dreams, but I remember waking up and feeling like, wow, I don't know what that was, but I had some really cool dreams. And then feeling like, oh, I need to throw up. And I, like, jumped out of bed, ran down the hall to the bathroom, and then started throwing up. But, like, throwing up really violently, like, and this is, you know, this is in the morning, so I'd slept all night with this plant in my body.
Yeah.
And then I started sweating really heavily, like, from my face, like, sweat was pouring down my face, and that's when I was like, oh boy, this is not good. And that's kind of the last thing I remember. Like, I threw up, like I said, I threw up a lot, started sweating, and then I blacked out and had a seizure.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And so Bethany heard me, you know, probably convulsing in the bathroom, and ran down the hallway and, you know, could see that I was, you know, clearly writhing on the floor and not breathing at the time. And so we had some roommates living next door, banged on the wall and got them to call for help. And they called an ambulance. And, you know, like, this is, I don't have any memory of this really, cause I was, blacked out. I don't know at what point I started breathing and what, or whatever, but, I do have a vague memory of the paramedics coming and telling me to stand up. And this is the thing that I, you know, I have kind of half memories of, but Bethany has very vivid memories of that. The paramedics, you know, saw us, like, young hippie farmers. And they're like, what did you take? What are you on? Like,
yeah.
You know, just assuming that we were on some drugs. And we're like, nothing. We ate these plants. And they're like, well, what did you think they were going to do? Like, you know, clearly they thought we were, you know, eating some hallucinogenic mushrooms or something, like, whatever it was. And we're like, Bethany was like, well, we just cooked them with our sweet potatoes. Like, we just thought they would be dinner. And so, you know, finally the paramedics got me in the ambulance, and I remember waking up in the hospital. And then, you know, them basically being like, you clearly ate something extremely poisonous. So, and I didn't know this at the time, but my friend, remember I said I had my friend who had joined us for dinner and had eaten some of this thing too. We hadn't seen her all night, but she lived in a sort of the other side of the house, and she had been sick too. So she ate a tiny little nibble of this plant, and she had gotten up and thrown up as well. So she was at the hospital as well because she, you know, heard about the whole drama and checked herself in.
Yeah.
And the doctors, I remember, this is where I got really freaked out because, you know, they were like, there's nothing we can do for you. Like, you know, we would have pumped your stomach, except you basically pumped it yourself. Like, had thrown up so much that there was nothing left. And that was like, I was freaked out. I was like, holy smokes. I mean, Beth got sick right away. My friend Natalie got sick right away. I slept for, you know, probably at least 8 hours with this stuff in my stomach. And then not really realizing till the next day that this was like the most poisonous plant in North America, or at least in our region. And just being like, holy smokes, that is just like, what are the chances of that? It's just like, you know, one of these moments where it was just really put life in perspective. Like, so I was just stunned, right? And then I remember like being in the hospital and then weird stuff was happening with my body. Like, so that, you know, the doctors took some tests and, you know, they took a urine test and the doctor was like, you know, the signs are coming back that you're diabetic, which I'm not, or I, you know, and I was like, oh my gosh, did this plant give me diabetes? And I don't know. But it turns out, so the plant is water hemlock, which, you know, for those listening who know about plants more than I did back then are probably just like, oh my God, this guy's absurd. It's like super deadly poisonous plant. And, you know, there's records of cows eating these plants and dying.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the stats that I remember reading about it are like 1 in 3 people who consume this plant die. You know, 3 of us ate it that night and we all lived to tell it to
you.
So we really beat the odds, but, you know, it's just a real fluke. So it was, you know, it was just kind of the things where like doing work, some research after and realizing, wow, so this plant has very, very strong neurotoxins. So, which explain the seizure, this part of it. And, you know, I had all these other effects on my body too, that I can't even understand, like the, you know, the sugar showing up in my blood and my urine that made it look like I was diabetic. And, you know, it was just probably my body processing it and trying to figure out what to do with this toxin that I had ingested. Another thing that I learned after the fact was that this medicine was used like in ancient Greek times. At least the story goes that it was used as a poison. Like they would give it to people like as a death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the plant that was used to kill Socrates. I don't know, way back then. I don't know what date that was.
Is that poison hemlock or water hemlock?
I'm not too sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what I remember looking up and reading, and so I don't know what the difference is between those plants. It could be poison hemlock. I'm not too sure. But
it might be the poison hemlock, which is native to Europe and North Africa.
Okay, that would make sense.
But they're so easily confused. Like, I don't know the difference.
Right.
I don't know the difference. So it's like...
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. I mean, it was really like... So again, this real, real eye-opening moment, and then learning about this plant after the fact, you know, learned that it's in the same family as the wild carrot or Queen Anne's lace, which is a very commonly used wild harvested plant, you know, whether it's for its seeds or, you know, people dig up the roots and eat them. So it's, you know, it's very closely related, you know, to the untrained eye, they look quite similar. So it's really important to, you know, to know what you're looking at and know what plants you're working with.
The first time I told some kids about your story, they were interested in wild carrot. They're like, we can eat this.
Mm-hmm.
And I made them ID it 5 times. They needed 5 things to show that this was wild carrot and was not poison hemlock.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them, these were like 10-year-olds, and we gave them 2 or 3 field guides, and they had to ID it properly with each field guide and ID it distinctly from poison hemlock.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent all day IDing it. And at the end of the day, they were like, can we eat it? Can we eat it? I'm like, sure. And because it was late fall, it was wild carrot. They were correct. Mm-hmm. But because it was late fall, it was all hard and woody, so they didn't even want to eat it anyway. So they spent all day doing the work. But it was great. It was great. But it, like, hearing this story reminds me so often as someone who I literally hand kids plants to try and to eat. Mm-hmm. And I feel confident I would never hand them anything that I don't feel 100% on, mm-hmm. that I've already eaten millions of times. So I stick to like very basic plants, mm-hmm. that we know. Mm-hmm. But I appreciate hearing stories like this so that it reminds me to approach it still with care, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I absolutely. And it, like I said, it was such a humbling experience because I was, like I said, just like, you know, almost, frantically trying to absorb information at that time and learn, and just like, oh, everything was interesting and exciting. And it was just like this event happened and it was just really stopped me in my tracks. Like, oh, you know,
yeah,
you know, just really get clear about what you're working on here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really value the work that you're doing with these kids. And, you know, just imagine like poring over that plan in such detail and spending that day looking at that plan and getting to know all the specifics of it. Like, they'll probably never forget that.
I hope.
You know?
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, that's a real lesson in like, take time and take care, that I didn't have, you know? And I was just like, looks like this. What could go wrong?
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
Then just charging ahead and ignoring all the signs that, you know, even my wife's signs, like, hey, I don't have a good feeling about this, you know, an intuitive feeling that's coming from somewhere, some like deep survival mechanism is like alarm bells are going off.
Yeah.
Like, no, try to carry on.
Yeah.
So I really, you know, again, just, I really appreciate that you're doing that work with, you know,
I appreciate you sharing the story. Yeah. You know, that's also important. Were there any lasting, I mean, I guess those are your lasting lessons of like just research a lot more. And you said before finding like a mentor, someone to help you learn a bit better or,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it, like I said, again, like it's so humbling, to really sort of like, I feel like it was, you know, I can look at the side where it's just like, wow, I beat the odds. You know, there's that sort of perspective. Yeah. And then there's also the perspective of like, wow, that plant had a serious lesson to teach me. Like it, mm-hmm. that plant sat me on my ass and like, look at it.
Yeah.
Here's how it's going to be. Because, you know, the way that I was moving through the world at the time was just like, wow, all this stuff. And it's like, it's all for me. And, and really just to get clear, like, you know, there are so many forces in nature that are there, and they are a force. Like they will take you out without hesitation.
Yes.
You know, and so it's really to have reverence for the natural world and respect, and, you know, to ask questions and to not, you know, charge forward with the ego of like, well, it's, you know, it's just the way that humanity has dominated the natural world, or that we try to suppress it for our own gain. It is the same thing that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, what could go wrong? How, you know, I'm, you know, it's this small little plant. Like, what's, you know, what could the impact be? And not taking the time to listen, or not taking the time to just sit with that plant and really get to know it. Like,
yeah.
I really think that could have saved a lot of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a lasting thing for sure. Just like, tread carefully and ask good questions.
So I appreciate that friend's newfound consideration, newfound respect, newfound awareness that it's important to respect and encounter these plants in a good way. And I think that's the key to this plant. That's the key to the water hemlock. Respect, and to know, and to learn. And these teachings that we get from them, I'm gonna share a little bit more later, but I want to get into the poison a bit more. And I've read that consuming a single portion of the root, the width of a finger, can be fatal to an adult. Obviously it wasn't for my friend, but again, he was strong, robust health, very healthy young man, and I think his body did well in the circumstances. And even though the root is the most toxic part of the plant, the whole plant is toxic, all of it. The toxins can be seen clearly in the root as that yellow oily liquid, which is exposed when broken or cut open. The more yellowy the liquid observed, the more yellowy liquid observed in the root, the more toxins are present. And that yellow goo is a mixture of concentrated unsaturated alcohols made up of cicutoxin, and cicutol. These are pilenes. I think that's how I pronounce it. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Pilenes, and they act quickly and directly on the central nervous system. And I've read that symptoms begin setting in between 15 minutes to 60 minutes to an hour. And again, the symptoms include increased salivation, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, seizures, widely dilated pupils, fever, low heart rate, severe abdominal pain, low blood pressure, delirium, coma, anoxia. That's when the tissues aren't getting the oxygen they need. And death is eventually caused by cardiopulmonary arrest and usually occurs between 1 to 8 hours. Other clinical signs that I've seen include sweating, strange chewing movements, slightly bulging eyes, clamping of the jaw, and strange twitching in the face. And a lot of these symptoms that are observable like this are observable in other animals as well, like livestock. Survival is possible after the ingestion of water hemlock, but help must be sought out quickly and the proper treatment administered, which usually consists of flushing the body of materials consumed and administering some sort of anti-seizure medications. A complete recovery usually takes several days. And I've said in the past that a few bites of the root could kill a cow. And according to some new meat research to me, I think this is untrue. I think this is untrue that maybe a couple of bites of the root could kill a cow. In Toxic Plants of North America, Burroughs and Turrell, 2001, I think it was the University of Iowa, or Iowa State University Press, they write that a few bites of the root show clinical symptoms in cows. While cows have been recorded as consuming the plant, it would take more than a couple of bites to kill them. But one record in 1983 cites that 10 bull calves died after consuming water hemlock in a wet area where they were grazing. Toxicity appears to be variable by season and geographic location. And this makes sense, you know, because in the height of the summer when the plants are in flower, most of the plant's energy goes into the production of those flowers and eventually to the fruit and seed. And then in the late fall, as the aerial parts of the plant begin to wither and die back, those roots, they reabsorb all of the energy and likely all the chemical constituents of the plant. Burroughs and Terrell also noted that water hemlock is most toxic in the dormant season, making sense. You know, like the plant goes back into its roots. The ground is warmer than the air around it. And so all of it just comes back down and sucks into the roots. And when you're looking for fresh roots to eat in the fall or in the spring, like people do when they're looking for root medicines, that's probably the most dangerous time to be encountering this plant, to be consuming this plant. Craft uses. None that I've come across, although I've heard and read of a number of poisonings of children that have occurred due to the use of water hemlock for pea shooters. And I don't know how many kids make pea shooters anymore, but I guess it was a fashion back in the day to be making them. And people used water hemlock. I teach your kids about elder. They have a similar flower, but they're opposite branching, and they're taller and woody. And yeah, you can use elder for pea shooters. You don't need to use water hemlock. But even the elder stalks might not be appropriate. Some people have talked about them being sick. So maybe don't use elder. Maybe we just don't need pea shooters. You know? Kids should be eating peas. I don't know what they should be doing, whatever they want to do. So I'm going to read you these notes that I wrote about why I like it, but then I'm going to pontificate more, I guess. Water hemlock is an amazing and powerful, valuable teacher. I introduce all of my students to this plant and take the time to cover all of the identifying features and discuss the common lookalikes. If you come across an individual hemlock in an area where they may be frequently encountered by small children, my adult students and I, we dig up the plant and remove them, using the chance to look carefully at the roots. This is done in hopes of demystifying the plant and establishing a new relationship of respect, awareness, and attention instead of fear. I also wonder as who else in the world I might once have looked at with fear and anxiety, who else I might have looked at with derision, or how maybe I was once taught or trained to look at water hemlock. But could I take the time now to orient myself to this new, this being in a different way and take the time to be in a better relationship with them? Many consider water hemlock to be a plant that teaches boundaries and limits. We're reminded that not everything is for human consumption and enjoyment, and that there are places in the woods that maybe we aren't supposed to go. Maybe these are like sentinels, these boundary plants, saying, you know, this is not your space. Back up or go around. Maybe water hemlock, when we talk about propagation, could be planted in a way to protect areas, to say, hey, don't go here. This is the territory of someone else. This is not your territory. Personally, I'm so incredibly grateful to the powerful teachers in my life, including the water hemlock. After studying water hemlock for so many years now and observing where and how they grow, watching who they interact with and how they exist in the world, I see a plant which is resistant, reviled, and full of lessons that all of us can be learning from. And I don't think I've reached a point where the lessons are over. I think that there are still profound lessons for me to learn from them, and it's just going to take more time sitting with them, learning from them, watching how they grow, who they interact with. And remembering those things. And I need that. To be reflective here, I need a lot of reminders of boundaries. And I need a lot of reminders of you don't get to go here. You know, I explore widely and thoroughly in especially the Aramosa River Valley, but like everywhere I go. I go and explore the woods, and I go far, I trespass, I do everything to explore and learn more about the land. And maybe there are areas that I can be reminded by the hemlock, and even if it doesn't even have to, they don't even have to be there, but maybe they can remind me that there are certain areas that are sensitive, especially wetlands, where as I move through them, I need to be mindful, and I need to be aware, and I need to maybe pull up that question of do I need to go here? Is there another way I could learn without having to tromp through this wetland? And I think there are ways, you know. The water hemlock doesn't grow in the middle of the river. I could take the river instead. Bring a canoe or just walk through the river. It's a beautiful way to explore. And minimal impact. I wonder what other lessons are being held, or could be held, or could be taught. I can learn and observe from the water hemlock. And I also welcome if other people have gotten lessons, like that sort of poison report back from my friend. I want to know what lessons people are learning from this plant. I've, like I said, I've developed this relationship, but that doesn't mean I know everything, and I don't. I know I don't. I'm still learning more all the time. I'm being corrected all the time, both by other human researchers and by what I observe. So I appreciate learning from other people. If anybody has any insight, please share. So some of the resources that I've used to do this write-up and make this episode was Botany in a Day by Thomas Elpel on Hops Press. The Newcomb's Guide to Wildflowers by Lawrence Newcomb, Little Brown and Company. Ontario Wildflowers by Linda Kershaw on Lone Pine. Incredible Wild Edibles by Sam Thayer, Forager's Harvest. I just want to stop for that one because, again, I know I just talked about Sam Thayer a couple episodes ago on the Mulberry episode, but damn, is that a good write-up on the water parsnip and then comparing it to Cicuta and Cicuta maculata and Cicuta bulbifera and the other Cicuta species, which could be commonly mistaken. Great chapter in that book. Again, that book is Incredible Wild Edibles by Samuel Thayer. I should just write to him and ask if he wants to be on the show, because I keep quoting from his books. The Book of Swamp and Bog by John Eastman, Stackpole Books. North American Guide to Common Poisonous Plants and Mushrooms by Nancy J. Turner and Patrick von Anderkass. And the freaking tome, which I'm so grateful for the University of Guelph for giving me a community card so I can take books out, because this was huge and had a great detailed chapter on water hemlock. Toxic Plants of North America by George E. Burroughs and Ronald J. Terrell, Iowa State University Press, 2001. And I think that's the first edition. No, it wasn't the second, but the first edition. Big honking book all about poisonous plants. And I had to return it, but I did read through the water hemlock a couple of times. That was a great book. Yeah, check out the blog, tonowtheland.com/blog/exploringwaterhemlock, or just tonowtheland, exploring water hemlock in Google, whatever. And you can see all the photographs. I've been trying to take a lot. I've taken a lot throughout the years, but the summer as well. It's been my summer plant, I suppose. You can also check it out on Instagram at tonowtheland. And that's where I first shared that I wrote this article and mentioned that I was going to do the podcast episode so people can listen to it, because not everybody wants to read long articles anymore. You can always email me, tonowtheland@gmail.com. And that way I can hear from you about what you're seeing, and you can teach me, and we can share in this process of learning together, you, me, and the water hemlock. And I think, again, the best thing to do, I always say this, is the dirt time, right? Is to get outside and go learn. The reason why I'm in the car in the first place is I'm on my way up to the tracking apprenticeship that I help out with. And so we're going to go out probably on Sunday and probably get into an area, a forest, where I've seen water hemlock growing a lot. So maybe I can take some more photographs and talk to some more people about them. I hope you like the show. Sorry if I'm rambling on too much. But this plant's important, wonderful to me. I like it a lot. If you want to support the show, you can always go to tonowtheland.com/donate. Check out the Patreon link or send PayPal. I really appreciate it. Thank you, everybody who's already supporting the show. That means a lot to me. I'm trying to find a way to migrate the account for the website so that I can get the email list going, because I feel like that works and a lot of people have signed up, but I have no email list yet because I'm still trying to figure out how to do that. So I think that's what any money coming soon will go towards. But yeah, thanks for listening. Take care.